Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center, reading news stories from Reuters for Thursday, February 19, 2026. King Charles's brother Andrew arrested over misconduct relating to Epstein. London. King Charles's younger brother Andrew Mountbatten Windsor was on Thursday arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office over allegations he sent confidential government documents to Jeffrey Epstein. Mountbatten Windsor, who turned 66 on Thursday, was arrested and questioned by detectives from Thames Valley Police. Earlier this month, the police force said it was looking into allegations that he had passed documents to the late convicted sex offender while working as a trade envoy. The arrest of the senior royal, eighth in line to the throne, is unprecedented in modern times. I have learned with the deepest concern the news about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor and suspicion of misconduct in public office, King Charles said in a statement. Although Buckingham Palace was not informed in advance about the arrest, Charles said the authorities had the family's full and wholehearted support and cooperation. Let me state clearly, the law must take its course. Meanwhile, my family and I will continue in our duty and service to you all, his statement said. The former prince, the second son of the late Queen Elizabeth, who is in police custody, has always denied any wrongdoing in relation to Epstein and said he regrets their friendship. Mountbatten Windsor's office did not respond to a request for comment, and he has not spoken publicly since the release of more than 3 million pages of documents by the U.S. government relating to Epstein, who was convicted of soliciting prostitution from a minor in 2008. Those files suggested Mountbatten Windsor had, in 2010, forwarded to Epstein reports about Vietnam, Singapore, and other places he had visited on official trips as the government's special representative for trade and investment. He was forced to step down from that role in 2011 after his close links to Epstein first emerged. Following a thorough assessment, we have now opened an investigation into this allegation of misconduct in public office, Thames Valley's Assistant Chief Constable Oliver Wright said in a statement. We understand the significant public interest in this case, and we will provide updates at the appropriate time, he added. The arrest marks a new low for the former prince, who was forced to quit all official royal duties in 2019 over his ties with Epstein, and was then stripped by his older brother of his titles and honors last October, amid further revelations about their relationship. While Mountbatten Windsor is being held in police custody for questioning in an unspecified location, six unmarked police cars and around eight plainclothed officers were pictured at Wood Farm on the Sandringham Estate in eastern England, where he now resides. Thames Valley police officers were also searching the mansion on the King's Windsor Estate, where Mountbatten Windsor lived until he was forced out amid anger at the Epstein revelations. While being arrested means the police have reasonable suspicion that a crime has been committed and that the royal is suspected of involvement in an offense, it does not imply guilt. A conviction for misconduct in a public office carries a maximum sentence of life imprisonment, and cases must be dealt with in a crown court, which deal with the most serious criminal offenses. Police have previously said misconduct in public office, which is a common law offense and is not covered by written statute legislation, involved particular complexities. In 2022, the King's brother settled a civil lawsuit brought in the United States by the late Virginia Giuffre, who accused him of sexually abusing her when she was a teenager. The current police investigation is not related to this or any other allegation of sexual impropriety. Today, our broken hearts have been lifted at the news that no one is above the law, not even royalty, the family of Giuffre, who died by suicide last year, said in a statement. Were Mountbatten Windsor to ultimately face criminal charges, he would join a very small group of senior British royals who have formerly been accused of offenses. His elder sister, Princess Anne, was fined for speeding in 2001, and the following year became the first royal to be convicted of a criminal offense in 350 years when she appeared in court to plead guilty to failing to stop one of her dogs, named Dottie, from biting two children. King Charles I was tried for treason in 1649, towards the end of the English Civil War, found guilty, and beheaded. The misconduct investigation is not the only accusation against Mountbatten-Windsor into which police are looking. Anti-monarchy campaign group Republic has reported him over allegations he was involved in the trafficking of a woman to Britain for sex in 2010. Thames Valley Police said it was assessing allegations that a woman had been taken to an address in Windsor, where the former prince lived until recently. U.S. lawmakers have also said he should testify before committees in the United States over what he knew about Epstein. Meanwhile, former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has also called for a police investigation into the extent of Epstein trafficking women without proper checks by the authorities through London's Stansted Airport, saying this had been overlooked by previous inquiries into Mountbatten-Windsor. Essex police said on Wednesday it was looking into the issue. South Korean court hands life in prison to ex-President Yoon for insurrection. By Joyce Lee and Minwoo Park. Seoul. A South Korean court sentenced former President Yoon Suk-yeol to life in prison on Thursday after finding him guilty of masterminding an insurrection linked to his December 2024 attempt to impose martial law. Prosecutors had sought the death penalty in the case, closely watched in a deeply divided country. It is the most consequential of a series of trials for the ousted leader, whose bid triggered a national political crisis and tested democratic resilience. Yoon conspired with his then-defense minister, Kim Jong-hyun, to subvert the constitutional order by deploying troops to parliament, intending to paralyze its functions, Judge Ji Kyu-yoon told a packed courtroom. It is the court's judgment that sending armed troops to parliament and using equipment to try to make arrests all constitute acts of insurrection, he said, speaking for the panel of three judges. Yoon led a number of officials and troops in criminal activities on December 3, 2024, and, because of the martial law declaration, an enormous social cost was incurred, Ji said as he handed down the life term for the former leader. Wearing a dark navy suit without a tie, Yoon, 65, stood ashen-faced as the sentences were read out for him and seven other defendants, including Kim, the former defense minister who received 30 years, and former top police officials. Yoon's defense team will discuss with him whether to appeal the ruling, with one of his lawyers, Yoon Kab-kyun, saying it completely ignored the key legal principle of basing findings on evidence. A lawyer for Kim said the former defense minister would, of course, appeal. A prosecutor said the team had some regret over the sentencing, but declined to say whether they planned to appeal. Before delivering the verdict, Judge Ji reviewed the long history of treason and insurrection, from the Roman Empire and the medieval era to the trial and execution of England's Charles I for waging war against Parliament. Masterminding an insurrection carries a maximum sentence of the death penalty or life imprisonment under South Korean law. The country last handed down a death sentence in 2016, but has not executed anyone since 1997. Yoon denied the charges. The conservative former career prosecutor said he had presidential authority to declare martial law, and his action was aimed at sounding the alarm over opposition parties' obstruction of government. The ousted former leader is likely to remain held at the Seoul Detention Center. He can appeal the ruling and again challenge any appellate court decision at the Supreme Court. Judicial guidelines say the first trial should conclude within 6 months, and the entire process, including appeals, in 2 years, but trials often exceed that. Yoon, who has faced 8 trial proceedings, is appealing a 5-year jail term handed him in January in a separate trial on charges including obstructing attempts by authorities to arrest him after his martial law declaration. While Yoon's bid to impose martial law lasted only about 6 hours before it was met by large street protests and voted down by parliament, it sent shockwaves through Asia's fourth-largest economy, a key U.S. security ally, and long considered one of the world's most resilient democracies. Ko Jeong-suk, 65, who watched the court decision at Seoul Station, said the martial law bid deepened social divisions. "I really think it should have been the death sentence so that this doesn't become an example to repeat." But hundreds of Yoon's supporters rallied outside the court complex, calling for him to be freed. In a post on X, President Lee Jae-myung, a liberal who won the presidency in a snap election in June after Yoon's removal, commended the actions of the Korean people to thwart the martial law. "It was possible because it was the Republic of Korea," Lee said, using the official name of the country, "whose people would set an example for history," he added. His post ahead of Thursday's ruling was attached to a newspaper report that some academics had recommended a Nobel Peace Prize nomination for the Korean public, which faced down troops and police to oppose martial law without violence. Top European spies skeptical U.S. will clinch Ukraine peace deal this year. By Tom Baumforth, Graham Slattery, and Jonathan Landay. Munich. European intelligence chiefs are pessimistic about the chances of an agreement being reached this year to end Russia's war in Ukraine, despite Donald Trump's assertions that U.S. brokered talks have brought the prospect of a deal reasonably close. The heads of five European spy agencies, who spoke to Reuters in recent days on condition of anonymity, said Russia did not want to end the war quickly. Four of them said Moscow was using the talks with the U.S. to push for sanctions relief and business deals. The talks, the latest round of which took place in Geneva this week, are negotiation theater, one European intelligence chief said. The remarks point to a striking gulf in thinking between European capitals and the White House, which Ukraine says wants to clinch a peace agreement by June ahead of the U.S. congressional midterm elections in November. Trump says he believes Russian President Vladimir Putin wants to make a deal. "Russia is not seeking a peace agreement. They are seeking their strategic goals, and those have not changed," one of the European intelligence chiefs said. "These include the removal of Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky and for Ukraine to become a neutral buffer to the West." "The main issue," a second intelligence chief said, "is that Russia neither wants nor needs a quick peace, and its economy is not on the verge of collapse." While the intelligence chiefs did not say how they obtained their information, their services use human sources, intercepted communications, and various other means. All said they consider Russia a priority target for intelligence gathering. Russia's foreign ministry did not immediately respond to a written request for comment. Putin says he is ready for peace, but on his terms. Russian officials say European governments have repeatedly been wrong in their assessments of Russia. Ukrainian and Russian negotiators met this week for their third U.S.-mediated meeting of 2026, without any breakthrough on key sticking points, including territory. After the meeting, Zelensky appeared frustrated by a lack of meaningful progress and suggested the Russians were more interested in discussing the conflict's historical roots than reaching a near-term agreement. "I don't need historical shit to end this war and move to diplomacy, because it's just a delay tactic," he wrote on X on Thursday. Moscow wants Kyiv to withdraw its forces from the remaining 20% of the eastern Donetsk region that Russia does not control, something Ukraine refuses to do. The second spy chief said Russia could be satisfied territorially if it obtained the rest of Donetsk, but that would not fulfill its objective of overthrowing Zelensky's pro-Western government. A third intelligence chief said there was a misplaced belief that Ukraine ceding Donetsk would quickly lead to a peace deal. In the case of the Russians getting these concessions, I think that this is maybe the beginning of actual negotiations, the official said, predicting Russia would then make further demands. The spy chief, without providing evidence, also expressed concern over the very limited level of skill in negotiating with Russia across the West, including on the European side, which Zelensky says should have an active role in the talks. The U.S. side is being led by Steve Witkoff, a real estate developer and longtime friend of Trump, and Jared Kushner, the U.S. president's son-in-law. Both men have worked on other conflicts on Trump's behalf, but neither are trained diplomats, nor do they have any specific expertise on Russia or Ukraine. In response to a request for comment, White House spokeswoman Anna Kelly said anonymous critics had done nothing to help end the war in Ukraine. President Trump and his team have done more than anyone to bring both sides together to stop the killing and deliver a peace deal. Two of the officials said Moscow was trying to separate the talks into two different tracks. One focused on the war, and a second focused on bilateral deals with the U.S. that would include sanctions relief for Russia. Zelensky said his intelligence services have told him that U.S. and Russian negotiators have been discussing bilateral cooperation deals worth as much as $12 trillion that were proposed by Russian envoy Kirill Dmitriev. The European officials did not provide details on these discussions, though Dmitriev himself wrote on X on Wednesday that the portfolio of potential U.S.-Russia projects is over $14 trillion. The second spy chief said the offer was designed to appeal both to Trump and to Russian oligarchs who have not profited from the war because of sanctions, but whose loyalty Putin needs to retain as Russia's economy hits stiffening headwinds. The official said that ultimately Russia was a resilient society that could endure hardship. However, the third official said Russia faced very high financial risks in the second half of 2026, citing, among other factors, Moscow's limited access to capital markets due to sanctions and high borrowing costs. Some analysts say Russia's economy is somewhere between stagnation and recession, after growing just 1% last year. The central bank's key interest rate, which shapes borrowing costs, stands at 15.5%. The liquid part of Russia's rainy day fund that the government uses to cover its budget deficit has more than halved since the 2022 invasion. Hamas tightens grip in Gaza as Trump pushes peace plan. By Nidal al-Mughrabi and Mayan Lubel. Cairo, Jerusalem. Hamas is cementing its hold over Gaza by placing loyalists in key government roles, collecting taxes, and paying salaries, according to an Israeli military assessment seen by Reuters and sources in the Palestinian enclave. Hamas's continuing influence over key Gaza power structures has fueled widespread skepticism about the prospects of U.S. President Donald Trump's peace plan, which requires the militant group to give up its weapons in exchange for an Israeli military withdrawal from the territory. Trump's International Board of Peace, which is meant to supervise Gaza's transitional governance, is holding its inaugural meeting in Washington on Thursday. Hamas is advancing steps on the ground meant to preserve its influence and grip in the Gaza Strip from the bottom up by means of integrating its supporters in government offices, security apparatuses, and local authorities, the military said in a document presented to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in late January. Hamas says it is ready to hand over administration of the enclave to a U.S.-backed committee of Palestinian technocrats headed by Ali Shaaf, a former Palestinian Authority official in the occupied West Bank. But it says Israel has not yet allowed committee members to enter Gaza to assume their responsibilities. Netanyahu did not respond to Reuters' questions about Hamas's control over Gaza. An Israeli government official, speaking on condition of anonymity, dismissed any notion of a future role for the group as twisted fantasy, saying, "Hamas is finished as a governing authority in the Gaza Strip." The Israeli military declined to comment on Hamas's assertions. Israeli military officials say Hamas, which refuses to disarm, has been taking advantage of an October ceasefire to reassert control in areas vacated by Israeli troops. Israel still holds over half of Gaza, but nearly all its 2 million people are in Hamas-held areas. Reuters could not determine the full scope of Hamas's appointments and attempts to replenish its coffers. Hamas has named 5 district governors, all of them with links to its armed Al-Qassam brigades, according to 2 Palestinian sources with direct knowledge of its operations. It has also replaced senior officials in Gaza's economy and interior ministries, which manage taxation and security, the sources said. And a new deputy health minister was shown touring Gaza hospitals in a ministry video released this month. Shaath may have the key to the car, and he may even be allowed to drive, but it is a Hamas car, one of the sources told Reuters. Israel's military appears to have reached a similar conclusion. Looking ahead, without Hamas disarmament and under the auspices of the Technocrat Committee, Hamas will succeed, in our view, to preserve influence and control in the Gaza Strip, it said in its assessment, which was first reported by Israel's Channel 13 News. This is the most complete account of the document's contents. Ismail al-Thawabta, director of the Hamas-controlled government's media office, denied these were new appointments, saying temporary replacements had been found for posts left vacant during the war to prevent any administrative vacuum and ensure residents receive vital services while negotiations continue over next steps in the peace process. The U.S. State Department and Shaath's National Committee for the Administration of Gaza, NCAG, did not immediately respond to requests for comment. A source close to the 15-member NCAG said it was aware of Hamas's actions and was not happy about them. On Saturday, the committee issued a statement urging international mediators to step up efforts to resolve outstanding issues, saying it would not be able to carry out its responsibilities without the full administrative, civilian, and police powers necessary to implement its mandate effectively. The appointment of Shaath's committee in January marked the start of the next phase of Trump's plan to end the war in Gaza, even as key elements of the first phase, including a complete cessation of hostilities between Israel and Hamas, remain unfulfilled. The Board of Peace is expected to receive reports on the committee's work on Thursday. Trump is also expected to announce countries that will commit personnel for a UN-authorized stabilization force and help train a new Palestinian police force, which the NCAG is expected to manage. Hamas is looking to incorporate 10,000 of its police officers in the new force, Reuters reported in January. They include hundreds of members of its powerful internal security service, which has merged with the police, two sources in Gaza said. Hamas's Thawabta dismissed the reports of a merger between the two forces as entirely unfounded, saying, "There has been no change whatsoever in their work or the scope of responsibilities of either one." Asked whether Israel would raise concerns about Hamas's entrenchment in Gaza at Thursday's meeting, Netanyahu's office did not comment. Israel has said repeatedly it opposes any role for Hamas in Gaza after it attacked southern Israel in October 2023, killing more than 1,200 people, according to Israeli tallies. Israel's air and ground assault on the enclave has killed more than 72,000 people, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. One of the stated goals of this campaign was dismantling Hamas governing capabilities in Gaza. The group seized control of the territory in a brief civil war with its political rival, Fatah, in 2007. Since then, appointments to government ministries and municipal offices there have been decided by Hamas's political wing. It also set up its own civil service, which employs tens of thousands of people. At least 14 of Gaza's 17 ministries are now operating, compared with 5 at the height of the war, according to the Israeli military document. At least 13 of its 25 municipalities have also resumed operations, it says. Thawabta said this relative recovery was not a product of political considerations. The organizational measures taken during the past period were necessary to prevent the collapse of the service system and do not conflict with any future arrangements agreed upon, he said in a statement to Reuters. According to the two sources, Hamas appointed the five governors, along with four mayors, to replace people killed or dismissed during the war. The selection of people with ties to its armed wing for the governor's roles was to crack down on armed gangs, they said, adding some had received weapons and financing from Israel. Netanyahu acknowledged Israeli backing for anti-Hamas clans in June, though Israel has provided few details. Since a violent campaign against its opponents in the first weeks of the truce, Hamas has focused on maintaining public order and collecting taxes in its side of the yellow line agreed to demarcate Israeli and Hamas-controlled areas, according to Israeli military officials and Gaza sources. There is no opposition to Hamas within the yellow line now, and it is taking over all economic aspects of daily life, an Israeli military official told Reuters. Mustafa Ibrahim, a political commentator in Gaza, said looting and robbery had stopped. Hamas is trying to organize markets and streets through the traffic police, Ibrahim said. Police stations have reopened. The tax department and economy ministry are working and collecting. Hamas collects taxes mainly from the private sector, the Israeli military document says. They include fees levied on Gaza merchants bringing in smuggled goods, such as cigarettes, batteries, solar panels, and mobile phones, according to three other sources, including a merchant. Hamas has earned hundreds of millions of shekels by taxing smuggled cigarettes since the war began, according to an Israeli document filed this month against a suspected smuggling ring, which includes Israeli reservists serving in Gaza. Hamas has also continued to pay salaries to public servants and fighters, which average around 1,500 shekels, around $500 a month, according to at least four Hamas sources. Every moment of delay in allowing the technocratic committee to enter the Gaza Strip leads to the imposition of a de facto reality, said Reham Auda, a Palestinian political analyst, increasing the administrative and security control of the Hamas government in Gaza. One security officer killed, another wounded, in IS attack in eastern Syria. By Faris Dalaiti and Khalil Ashawa. Damascus. Islamic State on Thursday claimed responsibility for an attack that killed one Syrian government security officer and wounded another in eastern Syria, marking an escalation in the group's attacks on the country's new leadership. The group said through its Amaq news agency that it carried out the attacks on Wednesday in Ragib town in Deir Ezzor province. A Syrian security source confirmed the two targeted officers were brothers. The incident marks the fourth attack claimed by IS against Syrian government forces, following an assault in the Swaida Desert in southern Syria in May and two attacks on security patrols in Aleppo and Idlib in December. The attack comes amid a rise in the group's operations in Syria. Last December, IS targeted a mosque in the central city of Homs with an explosive device, killing 8 people and wounding 18. U.S. military said on February 13 that it completed a mission to transfer 5,700 IS fighters from Syrian prisons to Iraq. This came after government forces seized swaths of the northeast from the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, including several jails holding IS fighters. IS considers Syrian President Ahmed al-Sharaa, a former al-Qaeda leader, who ousted President Bashar al-Assad in late 2024, a main enemy, and has repeatedly labeled him an apostate in its publications and monthly bulletins. Under Sharaa's leadership, Syria joined last December the Global Coalition to defeat IS, a move condemned by the group. In November, Reuters reported that Syrian authorities had foiled two assassination attempts against Shirah by the group during 2025. A report by the UN Office of Counterterrorism released last week said Shirah and two senior cabinet ministers had been targeted in five foiled assassination attempts by IS. How China plans to dominate global trade long after Trump, by Joe Cash. Beijing. China sees an opening to turn President Donald Trump's tariffs to its advantage by reshaping global trade in ways that would insulate its $19 trillion economy from U.S. pressure far into the future. Beijing is exploiting the uncertainty created by Trump to try to stitch China's vast manufacturing base into the world's biggest economic blocs, including the European Union, Gulf states, and a Trans-Pacific Trade Pact, a Reuters examination found. The push involves accelerating efforts to clinch some 20 trade deals in total, many years in the making, despite widespread concerns about China's overproduction, uneven market access, and soft domestic demand. A Reuters review of 100 Chinese-language articles by state-backed trade scholars written since 2017 reveals a systematic push by China's policy advisors to reverse-engineer U.S. trade policy and neutralize Washington's containment strategy. China is now putting that blueprint into action. The deal reached with Canada during Prime Minister Mark Carney's January visit to Beijing, which slashes tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles, was the first of many aimed at breaking U.S. leverage, according to interviews with 10 people, including Chinese officials and trade diplomats. "Don't interrupt your opponent when he is making a mistake," said one Chinese official of Trump's disruptive trade agenda. The review, drawn from over 2,000 trade strategy papers endorsed by the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, CASS, and Peking University, which advise top leaders, shows policy insiders broadly accept that painful structural change is a price worth paying for China's long-term dominance of global commerce. The paper's contents are reported here for the first time. If successful, Beijing could upend more than a decade of U.S. trade policy by placing itself at the heart of a new China-shaped multilateral order, two Western diplomats said. "The Chinese have a golden opportunity now," said Alicia Garcia Herrero, senior fellow at the Bruegel think tank. China's commerce ministry didn't respond to a request for comment about Beijing's strategy. Asked about China's approach, a U.S. official told Reuters it was no surprise that countries with large trade surpluses sought to maintain globalization. "President Trump is fixing the problems globalization caused for the United States, while other countries are trying to double down on globalization as free market access to the United States goes away," the official said. The shift in China's tone reflects its calculations. A year ago, Beijing was invoking Mao Zedong and its ability to fend off the West in the Korean War with martial propaganda. Now, as China prepares to welcome Trump in April, its diplomats are touring the world urging trading partners to join it in defending multilateralism and open trade. In January, China dispatched its top diplomat to tiny Lesotho, which Trump initially hit with a 50% tariff, to pledge development cooperation. On Saturday, state media said China would implement zero tariffs on imports from 53 African countries. Meanwhile, China is pitching AI-powered customs systems to neighbors and working to retool digital infrastructure that underpin commerce. The moves underline a goal identified in the policy papers to embed China so deeply in global trade that partners can't afford to decouple under U.S. pressure. In countering U.S. strategic competition with China, anti-decoupling should become China's primary focus, wrote Ni Feng, fellow at CASS's Institute of American Studies, in 2024. Chinese officials are now working to fast-track stalled trade talks. Since 2017, China has been negotiating with countries including Honduras, Panama, Peru, South Korea, and Switzerland. "We are willing to negotiate bilateral and regional trade and investment agreements with interested countries and regions," Commerce Ministry spokesperson He Yong-kyun told Reuters during Carney's visit, without elaborating. China's foreign minister, Wang Yi, surprised European negotiators in November by raising the prospect of a free trade agreement with Brussels during talks with his Estonian counterpart. A month later, Wang pressed the Gulf Cooperation Council to conclude long-running talks on a free trade agreement. In January, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer agreed with Chinese leader Xi Jinping to launch a feasibility study into a trade-in-services agreement that could reduce barriers for British firms. German Chancellor Friedrich Merz has said he will seek strategic partnerships with China during a trip next week. China's Commerce Minister Wang Wentao has made joining the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, CPTPP, a priority. The pact has its roots in the U.S.-backed Trans-Pacific Partnership, developed in part to counter China before Washington withdrew in 2017. But China's huge trade surplus complicates the pitch. Some member countries worry Chinese manufacturers may use improved market access to funnel excess low-cost goods abroad, while China's domestic demand remains sluggish. Wendy Cutler, chief negotiator during the Obama administration for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, acknowledged the window for Beijing to champion trade and multilateralism, but said China needed to go beyond talk. "And with its huge trade imbalances, as well as some of the coercive measures it's now taking against countries like Japan, it's hard to see how they're walking the walk," Cutler told Reuters. A senior European trade diplomat dismissed Beijing's overtures as pure Chinese propaganda, saying Brussels had no plans for a trade deal. Chinese advisors are undeterred. Speaking to Reuters, one noted the EU and China had negotiated a landmark 2020 investment deal during Trump's first term. The deal, however, was frozen in 2021 before it could take effect amid a dispute over human rights sanctions. Some Chinese advisors contend in the papers that Beijing should study how Washington has weaponized global institutions to contain China and exploit openings created by Trump's willingness to abandon or sideline multilateral bodies such as the World Trade Organization. Others argue Beijing should focus on influencing global standards in fields such as intellectual property through initiatives like Xi's Belt and Road Program and China's membership of the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which covers about 30% of global GDP. China is now applying those insights. Its recently upgraded deal with Southeast Asian states, for example, focuses on AI-driven and digital trade, where China hopes to secure a first-mover advantage. Indeed, China's vision for customs processing is evident at its Friendship Port on the Vietnamese border, where state media says homegrown AI solutions have slashed waiting times by 20%, enabling faster deliveries. Reuters couldn't independently verify the claim. The risks that China's $1.2 trillion trade surplus poses to trading partners' manufacturing sectors are hard to overlook, however. Pascal Lamy, former WTO Director General and EU Trade Commissioner, said Chinese firms are sending more goods to Europe than the bloc can absorb. "It's a mystery how, given the nature of the regime, given the sort of collective cleverness, how is it that they have not succeeded in rebalancing their economic model," he said. Not everyone sees closer ties with China as the easiest way to curb reliance on the U.S. Stephen Nagy, China project lead at the McDonald Laurier Institute in Ottawa, said Carney's tariff-cutting agreement with Xi appears designed to build leverage before talks over the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal. I think his bet is wrong, he added, predicting that Trump wouldn't be swayed. Carney has said Canada respects its USMCA commitment not to pursue free trade deals with non-market economies. His office didn't respond to a request for comment. Mexico, for its part, is wary of endangering U.S. market access by moving too close to China. We see no need for a free trade agreement with China right now, said a Mexican trade official. We are already in the CPTPP and have 60% of world GDP covered. Beijing's trade partners really need China to revive its consumption, said Fred Newman, chief economist for Asia-Pacific at HSBC. Wang, China's commerce minister, has said growing imports is a priority as Beijing prepares to launch its next five-year plan in March, in line with a commitment to raise consumption's share of GDP. But rebalancing is a long-term project. Trump has 3 years left in office, and the next administration could revert to building coalitions to contain China. China must study in depth the logic of U.S. actions within international institutions and the possible next steps it may take to better respond to increasingly fierce strategic offenses in the future. Zhao Pu, then at Renmin University and now a researcher at CASS's Institute of American Studies, wrote in 2023. Jose Balcazar, left-wing lawmaker, steps in as Peru's interim leader, by Lucinda Elliott and Cassandra Garrison. Jose Balcazar, a left-wing lawmaker who has faced backlash over comments about child marriage, became Peru's new leader after Congress elected him to serve as interim president following the removal of José Herri. The 83-year-old Balcazar of the Peru Libre Party assumes the presidency at a moment of deep political volatility and public distrust. He will serve on an interim basis until the winning candidate of general elections on April 12 and an expected runoff vote in June takes office on July 28. Peru's Congress on Tuesday voted to remove interim President Herri after just 4 months in office, following a scandal over undisclosed meetings with a Chinese businessman. Balcazar was among the lawmakers who supported his removal. Balcazar, a lawyer and former judge, drew criticism for remarks made during a debate on legislation banning child marriage in 2023, asserting that sexual relations among minors were routine, citing examples involving students and teachers. The comments prompted swift condemnation from rights organizations and government authorities. Balcazar was sworn in by Congress on Wednesday evening as interim president, also serving as head of Congress, after garnering enough support to defeat three other nominees, including center-right legislator Maria del Carmen Alba. "We are going to work to make the elections cleaner and to have new representatives," Balcazar said after the ceremony. Born in Nanchoc, in Peru's northern Cajamarca region, Balcazar holds a doctorate in law and political science. He worked for decades as a university lecturer and served as a superior court judge in Lambayeque, later holding a provisional post on Peru's Supreme Court. Elected to Congress in 2021, representing Lambayeque, Balcazar led the special commission charged with selecting magistrates to the Constitutional Court and served in senior roles on justice and education-related committees. Balcazar has faced both ethical and legal scrutiny. He is under investigation by prosecutors for alleged influence peddling and was permanently expelled from the Lambayeque Bar Association in 2024 for the presumed misappropriation of funds. Balcazar has denied the accusations. As interim president, Balcazar faces a narrow but critical mandate: maintain political stability, oversee an election marked by high voter indecision and fragmentation, and manage a peaceful transfer of power in July. As Peru braces for yet another transition, Balthazar's brief stewardship will test whether the country's political system can avoid sliding deeper into crisis. U.S. automakers caught in crossfire of Trump, California EV battle. By Chris Kirkham. Los Angeles. A legal clash between the Trump administration and California over auto pollution rules is coming to a head, with enormous financial implications for EV makers, including Tesla, and traditional automakers dependent on fossil fuel vehicles. California is challenging an unorthodox move by congressional Republicans to kill a waiver allowing the state to enact its own emissions regulations. If California wins, it could force U.S. automakers to comply with two diametrically opposed regulatory schemes, President Donald Trump's anti-EV policy and California's pro-EV regime, which 11 other states have adopted. California aims to require automakers to sell 100% EVs or other zero-emission vehicles by 2035, with aggressive interim targets that were set to begin this year. The Trump administration, by contrast, has killed federal EV subsidies and policy incentives, crashing electric vehicle sales nationally. California has set its own tougher auto pollution rules for decades with bipartisan federal support. Under recent Democratic administrations, those rules largely aligned with federal policies promoting EVs and more fuel-efficient vehicles. Now, California and federal regulations are heading in opposite directions. Trump eased some emissions regulations in his first term, only to see those efforts reversed by Democratic President Joe Biden. Now, in his second term, Trump is taking a scorched-earth approach to federal EV support. Congressional Republicans last year killed a $7,500 per EV subsidy and eliminated penalties on automakers failing to meet fuel efficiency standards. Trump's Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, last week overturned an Obama-era scientific finding that greenhouse gas emissions endanger human health, the foundation of EPA vehicle pollution rules first adopted in 2010. Ending the California waiver is essential to Trump's strategy, but the state's lawsuit alleges Congress has done it illegally. The administration filed a motion to dismiss the case that is scheduled for a federal court hearing on Thursday in Oakland, California. California argues Trump's EPA and Congress used a sleight of hand to reclassify California's waivers as administrative rules subject to reversal under the Congressional Review Act. For decades, the EPA noted in its California decisions that the waiver is not a rule and the act does not apply, a key point of California's lawsuit. If the administration wins, traditional automakers would face less pressure to sell money-losing EVs in California and the 11 other states, which together account for 29% of U.S. new vehicle sales, according to data provider S&P Global Mobility. Tesla and other EV makers could lose critical revenue from selling regulatory credits to other automakers that use them for compliance. If California wins, traditional automakers could be forced to develop different model lineups to suit two contradictory regulatory schemes in the United States. The Alliance for Automotive Innovation, an industry lobby group, argues that would restrict consumer vehicle choice, and has called the California rules an unaccountable, unachievable regulatory wormhole. Mike Murphy, a former Republican strategist who co-founded the advocacy group EVs for All America, said the California federal standoff highlights how automakers are being whipsawed by political shifts that upend their model development and manufacturing plans. Since Trump's election, automakers have taken $55 billion in write-downs on EV investments. What I hear from all of them is, this short-termism is killing us, he said. We have a monkey at the controls in Washington, and it's very hard to plan. White House spokeswoman Taylor Rogers called California's lawsuit frivolous and said Trump has canceled unpopular green energy subsidies that wasted Americans' hard-earned tax dollars. California started setting its own vehicle emission standards in the 1950s as it battled severe air quality problems from automotive and industrial pollution, including thick smog enveloping Los Angeles. Congress allowed California to keep that authority in the Air Quality Act of 1967, which gave the EPA the right to grant California a waiver to pursue its own regulations. Administrations of both parties have since granted the state more than 100 such waivers. In 2019, Trump's EPA rescinded parts of a waiver through a formal rulemaking, a slower process that California also challenged in federal court. The Biden administration reinstated the waiver in 2022. In Trump's second term, Republicans tried a shortcut, killing the waiver through the Congressional Review Act. The Government Accountability Office, GAO, an independent agency that has historically ruled on whether agencies are complying with the act, concluded last March that waivers are not rules because they are a case-specific individual determination, not a broad application of general principles. Congressional Republicans disregarded the GAO conclusion, arguing Congress has the power to decide what constitutes a rule. California sued the same day Trump signed the legislation in June. California Attorney General Rob Bonta told Reuters the case underscores the Trump administration's contempt for the law and use of fringe legal theories to justify violating it. They were told, they knew, they did it anyway, Bonta said in an interview, calling the move a dangerous expansion of congressional review powers. In a statement, the EPA said, "The only contempt for the law here is California's. We live in a democracy and Congress writes the laws," the agency said, adding that California's regulations would have crippled American industry and raised consumer prices. Legal observers say many questions in the case have never been tested in court, leaving few clues in case law to illuminate how the court might rule. "The level of instability and confusion here is unprecedented," said Paul Libous, an attorney at Van Ness Feldman LLP, who specializes in vehicle emissions policy. California's Air Resources Board, CARB, has told automakers that, for now, they can choose whether to comply with its new standards, but warned they could face penalties for noncompliance later if California prevails in court. Many automakers are choosing to comply, CARB records show. California originally adopted the regulations in 2022, when U.S. electric vehicle sales were projected to take off. The state now faces challenges in hitting its ambitious EV adoption goals as consumer demand wanes, raising questions about whether the targets are realistic. EVs accounted for 21% of the state's new car sales last year, down slightly from a year earlier. CARB has said it will not enforce this year's EV sales target, given the uncertainty over its regulations. Murphy, the former Republican EV advocate, said he expects automakers to compromise with California regulators because they cannot afford to bet that Trump's rollback of pollution standards will last beyond his administration, and they need to compete globally. EVs are essential in markets including China and Europe, where regulators are tightening vehicle emissions controls. Automakers understand, he said, that the drunken holiday with the federal regs is probably not going to last. Trump administration expands ICE authority to detain refugees, by Ted Hessen and Devika Madhusudanan Nair. Washington. The Trump administration has given immigration officers broader powers to detain legal refugees awaiting a green card to ensure they are re-vetted, an apparent expansion of the president's wide-ranging crackdown on legal and illegal immigration, according to a government memo. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security, in a memo dated February 18 and submitted in a federal court filing, said refugees must return to government custody for inspection and examination a year after their admission into the United States. This detain and inspect requirement ensures that refugees are re-vetted after 1 year, aligns post-admission vetting with that applied to other applicants for admission, and promotes public safety, the department said in the memo. Under U.S. law, refugees must apply for lawful permanent resident status 1 year after their arrival in the country. The new memo authorizes immigration authorities to detain individuals for the duration of the reinspection process. The new policy is a shift from the earlier 2010 memorandum, which stated that failure to obtain lawful permanent resident status was not a basis for removal from the country and not a proper basis for detention. The DHS did not respond to a Reuters request for comment outside regular business hours. The decision has prompted criticism from refugee advocacy groups. Afghan EVAC's President Sean Vandiver called the directive a reckless reversal of long-standing policy and said it breaks faith with people the United States lawfully admitted and promised protection. HIAS, formerly known as the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, said the move will cause grave harm to thousands of people who were welcomed to the United States after fleeing violence and persecution. Under President Donald Trump, the number of people in ICE detention reached about 68,000 this month, up about 75% from when he took office last year. Trump's hardline immigration agenda was a potent campaign issue that helped him win the 2024 election. A U.S. judge in January temporarily blocked a recently announced Trump administration policy targeting the roughly 5,600 lawful refugees in Minnesota who are awaiting green cards. In a written ruling, U.S. District Judge John Thunheim in Minneapolis said federal agents likely violated multiple federal statutes by arresting some of these refugees to subject them to additional vetting. That concludes this Thursday's reading from Reuters. My name is Jean, and it's been my pleasure to read for you.